Today's episode of Expanded Perspectives is sponsored by Gaia.com. Help find your own truth by exploring perspectives you won't find in the mainstream on some of life's biggest mysteries. Whether it's grand conspiracies, breakaway societies, UFOs, ancient civilizations, lost wisdom, as well as the paranormal, all at your fingertips. Stream videos anywhere from your living room or on the go with access to over 7,000 titles, all available to you with a monthly plan for only $9.95 a month. If you sign up now, the first month is only 99 cents. And there are multiple plans to choose from, including a three-month plan and an annual plan. If you enjoy expanding your perspective, then you'll enjoy Gaia.com. Gaia.com. G-A-I-A.com. And this episode is made possible by BlueApron.com. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Go to BlueApron.com/expanded today to sign up. They offer two plans to choose from, a two-person plan or a family plan that serves up to four people. Depending on the plan you choose, each week you'll receive 2 to 4 custom refrigerated boxes packed with ice packs and insulated liners to ensure your ingredients stay fresh. Also, complete step-by-step instructions informing you how to prepare each meal. Each week, they offer different meals, and you pick which ones you want sent to you. Shipping is always free, and you can skip any week you want to, and you can cancel anytime. Go to blueapron.com/expanded today to get started. All new chefs get $30 off your first delivery. blueapron.com/expanded. There, everybody, and thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. That's right, I'm Cam Hale, and with me, as always, over here, he's been pounding on the keyboard since we got in here, is my brother from another mudder, the Philly-o, Kyle Filson. Philly, you have been... Dude, I can't type like that. I don't know how you type so quickly like that, but I do... You've been typing a lot longer than I've been messing with it.
Yeah, I think it just comes from... doing you it for do. So long.
You just burn through it. I'm like, man, it makes me so dang mad. It's like, doggone it. It's like when you see a guy that can skate, ice skate. Kyle ice skates much better than I do. As fast as I can go forwards, he goes backwards. I'm like, you better get away from me.
Yeah, it's just something you pick up over time. I've been actually enjoying these new monitors we got. You know, it's so funny that technology...
From my old eyes?
You know, technology moves so fast that, I mean, I remember a couple years ago, when I say a couple, like two... This monitor I had was like state of the art at the time. I was like, I'm going to buy the bee's knees. I'm going for this one. Now it's like, it looks like a dinosaur, and it's only been 2 years. So I got a new monitor over here, and it's got no glare on it or nothing. I'm really enjoying it.
Dude, I'm telling you, I'm glad we got them. And dude, we don't buy expensive stuff. We just buy good stuff, and it works. And I need it for my eyes. Of course, I know you wear glasses, and I make fun of you from time to time when you have to wear them. I know I'm going to have to go in and get mine done.
Yeah.
I know I'm going to have to get them looked at, and I feel it coming, and it's just, dude, I have hard enough time keeping up with sunglasses and stuff, so this is going to be one of those things that it's going to be a pain. Yeah, I can already tell.
I don't wear my glasses as much as I was supposed to. Lots of times I wear them when I'm driving, and I always wear them when I'm at the office doing all my office work, because what I notice is it's not that I can't see so much as that I notice if I don't wear them and I look at a computer screen for a couple hours, I feel the strain. Where if I wear the glasses, I don't feel it.
Yeah. Kind of like when you start playing games and you start staring at the screen for too long, you forget to blink.
Oh, that happens to me all the time.
All the time.
It's like such an action-packed game going on. I forget to blink, and you're like, oh.
My eyes are... Let me ask you something here, too, while we're talking about this stuff, like funny stuff that we do. Have you ever yelled at one of your boys, whether it's good or bad or indifferent, and you always, because I've heard you do it, so I know your answer, and you mess up their names, like you can't really get it. And it doesn't even have to happen with the twins. Like it could just happen, you're yelling one of them and you call them Luke or whatever, just because you've got the names all jumbled up. Has that happened to you more than once?
Oh, it happens all the time, especially with the twins.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they're identical twins. Yeah. So for so long, you know which one I'm talking about. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's a reason.
Oh, what's that?
There's a reason. I'm going to jump into the news. Get a load of this. This comes from the NPR.org. It says that when the brain scrambles up names, it's because you love them.
Really?
Get a load of this. A woman named Samantha Deffler, when she was young, said her mother would often call her by her siblings' names and even the dog's name. She runs through the names Rebecca, Jesse, Molly, Tucker, Samantha, and all this. Says a lot of people mix up children's names or friends' names, but Deffler is a cognitive scientist at Rollins College in Winter Park, Florida, and she wanted to find out why it happens. So, of course, her and her colleagues, Cassidy Fox, Christian Ogle, and senior researcher David Rubin, did a survey of 1,700 men and women of all mixed ages. And they found that naming mistakes are very common. And most everyone sometimes mixes up the names of family and friends. And their findings were published in the journal, and I know you've got this, I've seen it at your house, Kyle, of Memory and Cognition.
Yeah, I've been a subscriber to them for about 8 years.
Yeah. It's a normal cognitive glitch, that she says. She said it's not related to bad memory or aging, but rather how your brain categorizes the names. Basically, I'm going to break it down for what this is. Your brain puts names in certain folders like you do on your desktop in your computer, okay?
Yes.
And when you have loved ones, your loved ones all pile into this special folder of loved ones. So all the names are in there. Well, the names that sound alike or are spelled alike the way your mind's eye sees them are competing with getting to first place in the brain. So when it pulls up, when you have Jacob and Caleb, when it pulls up, it's just whatever's competing at that moment that comes up forward may not be what your eyes recognize, but it's the way the name comes up. But they say mothers, especially moms, she says, Deffler says, any mom I've talked to says, you know, I've definitely done this. Talking about how it goes in here. Here's something else that's very interesting in this whole thing. They talk about this. Now, this comes from a fella named Neil Mulligan. He's a cognitive science at UNC on Chapel Hill. And this is what he has to say. As you are preparing to produce the utterance, you are activating not just their name, but competing names, like I was telling you about. And you flick through their names, and sometimes the competition wins. This is what I thought was interesting in this whole thing, though. They do say that not just humans are filed in there. Said sometimes a dog will be filed in there and it can string along, but that you're much more likely to be called a dog's name than you are a cat's name. That psychologically we categorize a dog with our family members, but never a cat.
That's weird.
And apparently they said they don't do cats and they don't do hamsters or really any other animal names. And then at the very last, the article says maybe that's why they call dogs man's best friend, but it is strange, but it makes sense. Your brain categorizes things like we've always talked about. It's categorizing this, and it's just whatever comes up. You're just thumbing through it, and when you see one close, your brain just latches onto it.
Yeah, that is interesting.
So it's pretty strange, right? That's how your mind works. It doesn't have anything to do with love or, oh, you love that one. But no, it's just that's the one that just popped into my mind.
Yeah, that's funny. check this out. They've been doing studies over in this part of the world for years now, and there's lots of theories about, you know, Egypt and places like that. But according to a new study recently published in the Journal of Science Advances, I'm sure you subscribe to that, evidence shows that humans occupied much of the Sahara during the wet period, which was around 8,000 years ago. They say that through analysis of marine sediments, recently researchers at the University of Arizona have determined rainfall patterns in the Sahara over a period of 6,000 years, and they obtained some fascinating results. Now, the University of Arizona-led team has identified the climate patterns for what they call was a green Sahara from 5,000 to 11,000 years ago. They said at that time, the region had 10 times the rainfall it has today. And so, as it turns out, they say what is now the Sahara Desert was then a home to hunter-gatherers who lived off animals and plants present in the savannas of the region. And they said there was even wooded prairies in the area sometime between 5,000 and 11,000 years ago. They said that annual rainfall in the Sahara right now ranges from about 4 inches to less than an inch per year. But back then, it was 10 times that. They say that researchers have already identified the existence of what they call a Green Sahara period. They said that this they were able to manage and compile a continuous record of rainfall in that region that existed all the way back to 25,000 years ago. They said archaeological evidence shows that humans occupied much of the Sahara during the wet period, but gradually withdrew some 8,000 years ago. Turns out the area was wet for a time, and then it began to dry up over a period of 1,000 years, and due to it drying up, people eventually moved out because you can't live in the middle of the Sahara Desert. But what I find so interesting is that they were able to back this up because years and years ago, our good friend, John Anthony West, called his friend, not then but now, Robert Schock. And he was the first one to postulate that the Sphinx was far older than it was and that it existed there during a time when there was a lot of rainfall. Mm-hmm. And Robert Schock agrees with that. You know, there was a documentary made in 1991 showing when they had presented all this evidence. We've talked about it on the show numerous times. What I like is, now they've been able to scientifically prove that those men's theories were correct. There was a wet period. There was a lot of rainfall. Mm-hmm. And that area, that part of the world, was lush and green and had forest and, I said, savannas. It had cattle, who knows what, and hunter-gatherers living on it, too. They found the evidence all around. They took core samples, it says, from 4 different spots throughout the Sahara, located hundreds of miles apart. And they've all the evidence backs up the idea that sometime 8,000 years ago, that was a wet, that was like a national, like a giant rainforest.
Yeah.
Not a national forest at that time. And now it has changed. So climate has been changing. I know that human beings, mankind, we're definitely having an effect on the climate. But also you have to realize that sometimes the climate changes even without man interfering.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you've heard the stories of that Antarctica wasn't always frozen, that at one time that had forest on it. You know, these maps and stuff. So it's pretty cool. The theory that those guys have been talking about, Graham Hancock's been talking about it. It's true. That was a rainy, wet part of the world 8,000 years ago.
Well, there's another interesting thing, too, because of the way it ties in. When you look at it, old ancient maps, like you and I have always talked about all the ancient maps, there's actually an ancient map called the Canepa map that comes from 1489. And that map is actually indicates on it. Now, they know that this map, when they did research into this, they state clearly that the map was actually based upon ancient source maps, much like we talked about the Piri Reis map when it showed Antarctica, you know, pre-ice. On this Canepa map, it shows a clearly marked massive river channel that cuts through the Sahara when it was fertile. Okay?
Yes.
Shows all that. Well, then now, of course, they do all this in 2005, like you're talking about. There's a radar survey was done. So they start seeing the Sahara. That's how they find out about all this. On that radar survey from 2015, that's whenever they found that invisible river channel. That's when they first saw it. So just 2 years ago. But yet this map from 1489 showed it. So they said somebody between the years of 5,000 years ago and 11,000 years ago lived there and mapped that entire area.
That's incredible.
Isn't that crazy?
It is. You know, the world is a dynamic place. It's changing all the time. If you got in your yard right now and just dig down 6 inches, what are you going to find? You're going to find fossils.
Yeah, sure.
Of oceanic animals.
Yes.
So you know, without a doubt, at one point where we're standing today was underwater.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt. So, I mean, who knows what could have been where? Like, the middle of the Atlantic could have been a big, you know, populace of people living, and where we're at now was underwater.
Yeah.
It just moves around. I don't know. Pretty incredible.
It's crazy. I got you something else that's pretty incredible, Brad. We always talk about the Smoky Mountain National Park and all the areas up around there in Tennessee. This comes from our friends at Cryptozoology News, folks.
Dun, dun, dun.
Tennessee resident startled by Bigfoot. Knoxville, Tennessee says Bigfoot made an appearance on a farm near the Smoky Mountain National Park. A fellow named David Pack was talking to Cryptozoology News, and he says he's got a friend named Lee that's 70 years old, and this past Wednesday was in his kitchen when he heard something. Now, he wasn't in David's kitchen. Lee was in his own kitchen. He's telling this story for Mr. Lee here. And he said that he heard some rustling and movement coming from the back porch. So Pat claims that Lee said it was around 10 p.m. and Lee thought it was the wind. So he looked out of the kitchen window of his ranch house, and he said in the backyard, and he could see that there was no wind. Said at that moment, Lee said he felt like someone or something was watching him. Now, we get this report often.
Yeah.
So he says he went in there and got the coat room, and he looked, you know, I guess, into it and goes out, and there's a little door, and he goes out on his back porch. And Lee said when he walked out on his back porch that that's when he saw this thing. And he said it kind of shook him up. Shook him up so much so that the old fellow went back in and got a gun. He said at first.
Oh, no.
Yeah, at first he thought it was a man, only to see the side and back of this creature as it turned and walked away down the porch and the sidewalk with his back to him. It never turned around, so we only got to see its backside. That says that the unidentified biped reportedly had long black hair on its arms and body. Although, Pat continues, it also had some brown hair. It scared Lee so bad. So he went for his pistol and then sat there waiting for it to come back. So apparently he was going back in, okay, to get his gun, and that's when it moved.
Really?
So he didn't get in time to get it. And then he comes back out. He goes and gets the gun, comes back, and he waits on it, nothing. Now, the old fella does say this. The old fella says that he's lived there in that area for 70 years, his whole life. He's never seen anything like it. And this is also what he says. He said he has seen black bear.
And he always
bear.
Feels like something's watching him, right?
Well, just that time. That's what he said he felt like. Was it? There you go. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. That's what he feels like. You son of a gun. He says that he's seen black bears on his farm before and that this was not a bear. He said, I don't think Lee would be interested in an interview because he didn't want to tell it, so he just wanted to have Pac tell the whole story. So, you son of a gun with his 80s. Here we go. Here we go. Well, folks,
okay,
we're going to go into break. When we come back from break, I'm going to touch on something. We touched just a second ago with Kyle talking about the ancient Sahara. We're going to get into something a little strange that I think it's strange because there's a lot of ties to a lot of different things. We've never really covered it, but we've talked about it in different episodes a little bit. We're going to come back. We're going to talk to you about the history of the Viracocha, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. And we are back with Expanded Perspectives. We're going to get into some ancient history talk, which is my favorite. I think it's everybody's favorite, pretty much. I mean, look, we all love all the stories of the weird and wild, but the ancient history is like something even wilder. You okay?
Yeah, some kind of bug or something.
It's like something just dive-bombed you from wherever that was at. But yeah, something almost got Kyle, folks. That'd have been awesome. Okay, guys. I suppose the best way to kick this topic off was to just jump in. I mean, toss out some lines. Let's see which ones get tangled up together. I'm going to ask you, Kyle. I'm going to ask all of y'all, fam. Do y'all happen to know what Leonardo da Vinci, Galileo, Charles Darwin, Abe Lincoln, and Aristotle have in common?
They have sexual maneuvers named after them?
That's the number two. That's number two.
Okay.
Number one, beards. That's right, folks. Yeah, facial hair. Beards, yeah. And it's here in the beard talk we're all about to pick up in is where we find our story. And the story is the legend of the Viracocha. Now, I'm going to read you something that was written down about this legend. It goes like this. At the dawn of the present time cycle, just after the great flood of Noah, recalled in the Bible and elsewhere, a mysterious group of God-men appeared at various locations around the planet to initiate the survivors of the cataclysm in the rudiments of civilization. Legends from Peru to Samaria, ancient Egypt to India, recount the arrival of godlike beings appearing after the Great Flood. Osiris and the Egyptian Thoth, India's Vishnu, Enki and Oannes of Sumerian and Babylonia, Quetzalcoatl and Viracocha in the Americas, are remembered in ancient worldwide legends as a group of beings collectively referred to as the Fisher Kings, fishers of men. Now remember that, because I'm going to come back to that. But we're going to talk about the Viracocha. That's where we're at here in the Americas. That's what we're going to get into. Now, there is a massive carved effigy to the Viracocha at Tiwanaku. And it's known as the Gateway of the Sun. And it's an ancient temple area there, folks. And it's covered by 48 winged effigies, flanked on either sides of this thing, right? Now, there's 32 that have human faces. There's 16 of these things with condors' heads. The greatest thing about it, though, is the Gateway of the Sun is carved from a single block of stone. Now, we've talked about the Olmec on here before and how they look African. Well, there's also countless images of bearded men with European facial features carved into pre-Columbian art and the architecture. And of course, like we say, much like the Olmec, it seems that this figure is something that is a little out of place, at least according to what we have as accepted history right now. So Olmec, you know, we know that's a little fringe. Viracocha seems to be a little out of the ordinary too. Now, oddly enough, around this time, multiple cultures develop agriculture in this time frame out of the blue and almost indigenously. I knew I'd mess that up, folks. So, it's very odd that you would think that it would just spring up like we've talked about. These ideas pop up out of the blue. You would think that, how does everybody just invent this on their own? You know, it doesn't spring up ideas like this and all that. So, there's also some very similar legends, like we've discussed, about a foreign person who gets deposited to this area from the water or from a great flood. And with them, they bring advanced knowledge and this gift of agriculture. And that goes back into what we just discussed of Quetzalcoatl, of the Viracocha, of Kukla Khan, and all this cultivation of corn and all these laws, basically, if you will, of civilization and how to get along with one another. You even go the Manu in India. And there's all these different areas in the world that you're going to come across this. Even so far as over into China, that they had found evidence of cultivation of rice starting around the exact same period as the agricultural springs up in these areas. So we want to believe that this is all supposedly, you know, by accident, but it seems to have been brought by this knowledge bringer, this person that shows up in this very dark time after the flood. So we can only imagine it's a cataclysm worldwide. And this is a time to where the people are scattered. They're having a hard time surviving. It's very tough for them. So we can only imagine how horrible. I think of the Book of Eli or the Road Warrior. I think of the things that we can relate to is when you start thinking about a post-apocalyptic time. Just because it wasn't a nuclear bomb doesn't mean it wasn't post-apocalyptic times. That's what it feels like. So, in the Andean creation story, the Viracocha first appears at Lake Titicaca, and with them they bring culture to these ancient peoples there in South America. Now it said they're fair-skinned and bearded. Notice I said fair-skinned. We're going to get into that later too. And the Viracocha, it said, traveled the countryside, of course, and they teach art and astronomy, geometry, some agriculture, and even all these different systems. Various ones that help improve the lives of the native peoples of this area. Now, there was a 16th century Spanish chronicler with the last name of Gamboa, Pedro Gamboa, and he wrote a book called The History of the Incas. And he tells two different tales of the Viracocha in this book, a pre and then a time of this. And I'm going to read you some from this. The first part says, the natives of this land affirm that in the beginning and before this world was created, there was a being called Viracocha. He created a dark world without sun, moon, or stars. Owing to this creation, he was named Viracocha, which means creator of all things. And when he created the world, he formed a race of giants of disproportioned greatness, painted and sculpted, to see whether it would be well to make real men of that size. He then created men in his likeness, as they are now, and they lived in darkness. Viracocha ordered these people that they should live without quarreling and that they should know and serve him. He gave them a certain precept, which they were to observe on pain of being confounded if they should break it. They kept this precept for some time, but it is not mentioned what it was. But as there arose among them the vices of pride and transgression, they themselves fell apart. As there arose among them their vices of pride and covetousness, they fell apart, and he confounded and cursed them. Then some were turned into stones, others into other things. Some were swallowed up by the earth, others by the sea. And over all there came a general flood, which they called water that overturns the land. They say that it rained 60 days and nights, that it drowned all created things, and that there alone remain some vestiges of those who were turned into stones as a memorial of the event and as an example to posterity in the edifices of Pukhara, which are 60 leagues from Kuzo. Some of the nations besides the Cusco also say that a few were saved from this flood to leave descendants for a further age. Each nation has its special fable, which is told by its people, of how their first ancestors were saved from the waters of the deluge, that the ideas they had in their blindness may be understood. I will insert only one, told by the nation of the Canaris, a land of Quito and Tumble Baba, 400 leagues from Cusco and more. So if you can tell where we're going with this, it sounds an awful lot like the flood myths that we were raised with in a Christian upbringing. It covers a lot of the same things. So you see that they're almost like the Viracocha wasn't just like these guys that showed up. They tell these stories almost as if they were the coming of Jesus, or if they were themselves, the Viracocha, were viewed at as God themselves.
Right.
You see, I mean, and it goes into more. They talk about more of this as they get into after the deluge. They say at the time of the deluge, as it comes back, and the natives point out that you go up on this mountain, and these waters kept increasing and rising, and everyone had to go up on this mountain, and it was finally covered by the flood, and there were these two brothers that were left. And then whenever the floods went down, that they started to come out, and the two brothers started to sow, begin to work the fields. And then one day, it says that they had been at work, and then returning, they found that some small loaves of bread, and they found this beverage that didn't come from their country, and it was made of boiled maize. And they go into all this like the Creator had brought it to them. So they tell the story of the Viracocha, much like the Creator stories. But then they also get into, like I said, there's a second part that they bring back. And they talk about, now look, there is a lot of stuff in these books that you can get into when you start really digging that sound almost, I don't know really how to go about saying it without it. It almost sounds like, I'm not sure if these people, the Peru people wrote it, you know, the Andean people wrote this, or if the Spaniard chronicler took it and wove it himself to make it sound more Christian. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, I understand what you're
saying. You know, like, I don't know if that's what, because we have to just assume that this is, we have to blindly faith go along with what we're reading and what we're learning about is true word for word what these people said. But if a chronicler was to come and he had an agenda, I would see that it could be woven that way too. I don't know. I'm not saying that's what's going on, folks. I'm just saying that you could see how these things could do this. Well, he also talks about this, and this is something I thought was neat. I want you to listen to this. They say that the moon was created brighter than the sun, which made the sun jealous at the time when they rose into the sky. So the sun threw over the moon's face a handful of ashes, which gave it the shaded color it now presents. Now, that's an odd way of looking at it, right? That's almost saying that the moon was creating its own light. That's kind of what that's saying, that if it's brighter than the sun, the moon's creating its own light. That's a very odd way of saying it's just some of the stuff that they say, you're like, man, that is really strange. Now, the chronicler, the fella goes in, and he starts talking about later on of how the Viracocha, what they look like, where they come from, where they say they come from anyway, they talk about the servants of the Viracocha, what they have. They set out on work, and it says that one went by the mountain range or chain, which they call the heights, over the plains of the South Sea. And the other went by the heights, which overlook the mountain ranges that they call the Andes. And this is his helpers. And that they go over there and they talk to the tribes and the nations, and they tell them with the Viracocha that commands you to go forth and multiply and settle the land. What does that sound like? It sounds much like the biblical teaching.
It does. Right?
Yeah. You go out there. And then it says that the Viracocha himself did the same along the road between those that he sent his servants on. The servants go left, servants go right. I go right up the middle. We're going to go out. We're going to spread this. They say that he also named all the tribes and all the places as he went past them. Some even say that at the sound of his voice, every place obeyed. That's what's written here. And people came forth, some from lakes, others from fountains, valleys, caves, trees, rocks, and hills, spreading over the land and multiplying to form the nations which are today in Peru. So we're getting into this now. It says, others affirm that the creation of Viracocha was made from the Titicaca site, where, having originally formed some shapes of large, strong men, which seemed to him out of proportion, and he made them again in his stature, which was, as they say, the average height of men, and being made, he gave them life. Thence they set out to people the land. As they spoke one language previous to starting, they built those edifices, the ruins of which may still be seen before they set out. So you're finding out all this stuff. This is, because see, I had no idea of this. My ideas of the Viracocha was just some guys just showed up, walked into a village and said, hey, let me show you something. Kind of like David Blaine does with the magic. He just walks up right to some folks. He's like, hey, check this out. It doesn't seem like that's exactly what originally where it was come from. Now, this is strange, and I want to read this to you. Viracocha is often depicted with his lower body covered in fish scales. Some have even postulated that he was a member of some advanced aquatic species, citing the brain capacity and communication methods of cetaceans, such as whales and dolphins. Others believe that the scales indicate that he was possibly a visitor from another land who arrived and departed from South America by some kind of boat or ship. Now, that right there is what we had kind of been taught. That's the Viracocha that I had heard of. Is like a man showed up by a ship. You know, he's riding on the back of a whale or the back of a turtle or things like this. Now, it says that though the Viracocha appears as a single central figure in both stone and story, some believe the figure represents an entire race of beings. Their hypothesis is that the Viracocha were refugees from the ancient civilization of Atlantis, and that in this view, that the Viracocha brought to the natives was the Atlantean knowledge and theory. So everything that they had learned and they had brought that out, that they had survived this cataclysm of their island sinking, whether or not it really sank or whether or not the ocean rose around it. But either way, they were able to get off and find refuge wherever they could. And then they tried to rebuild, much like what we've talked about. But here's something else that's interesting. The story that Enki tells the Sumerian Noah, he tells them, of course, to build an ark, much like the Bible's version, right? Mm-hmm. Getting ready for the great flood. But they also describe Enki, or Oannes, as the Lord of the Sacred Eye and God of Wisdom. And he is said to have emerged four times at long intervals from the subterranean ocean to teach what? Men the arts of civilization.
Yeah.
So even predating all the biblical writings, the Sumerian writings, comes up, saying the same thing. Here's what's odd. In the story that Enki tells, in the human form, it appears to be wearing a fish-tailed cloak, they say. And after educating mankind, he returns to the waters as darkness falls.
Yeah.
Now, how strange is that? So that comes even before the Viracocha tales. So all these old writings that we have seem to be linked together, seem to be following the same storyline. Now, somebody had to write the original, you know, just like there's a lot of knockoffs and remakes of movies. This could all be that. This could all be the teachings of remakes. That's all it could be. Or this could be the stories told of people bumping into other people, of something that was actually out there. And like we talked about, much like the mountain gorilla, stories told about the mountain gorilla till we finally saw one.
That's right.
You know, so you're looking at all this. They
discovered a new poisonous frog, by the way, in South America.
Oh, great. So see, that they're still out there. Mm-hmm. We're still finding things like that. This is what's interesting, too. It says, at Babylon, there was a great resort of people of various nations who inhabited Chaldea and lived in a lawless manner like the beasts in the field. And in the first year, there appeared from that part of the Euphrates Sea, which borders Babylonia, an animal destitute of reason by the name of Oannes, whose whole body was that of a fish, that under the fish's head he had another head, with feet also below, similar to those of a man, subjoined to the fish's tail. And his voice, too, and language was articulate and human. A representation of him is preserved even to this day. Now, that's strange. And they go into... It's odd to me, of course, that it seems like the fish. It comes from the sea.
This is totally different than South America.
This is totally different. This is coming from Inki. This is coming from the Sumerian language.
That's what I'm saying. But it's a very similar recount. Yes. Recount of the story is very similar.
And you can dig into this story. I mean, you can go deep into this story like that, too. So you're like, man, where is all this coming from? So we start talking about Oannes is called the Chaldean savior. And it's depicted with the head and the body of a fish, from which his human form protrudes at various points. Oddly enough, Jesus himself was often symbolized by a fish.
Mm-hmm.
And what did he tell his disciples? To become fishers of men, right? Yeah, teachers of men.
Yeah.
And that the sign of the fish was also the very first monogram of the Christians, right? So that's strange. And that the Greek name of Jesus means fish. And that the fish was accepted as a symbol of the Christ by a number of early canonized church fathers. St. Augustine likened the Christ to a fish that had been broiled. And it was also pointed out that the flesh of the fish was the food of righteous and holy men. So, here's something else that's going to be strange for you. In the Arthurian legend, the Fisher King, or the Wounded King, is the last in a long line charged with what? The keeping of the Holy Grail. Okay, that's the Fisher King in this story. Now, the wound is said to be in his groin, where he can no longer father children. And when he can no longer father children, he can no longer secure the next generation of man to carry on after his death. So now, in a roundabout way, what's that sound like? Now he can no longer help civilization move forward. Right?
Right, that's right, yeah.
Now, the tale tells also that not just the king suffers, but his lands and all that dwell in it suffered, resulting in him only being able to fish in a river near his castle. So, this whole story, of course, eventually ends with some knights coming to heal the king. But don't you think it's funny that even the old Arthurian tales speak of white-bearded men trying to secure the safety of the next generation?
It does seem odd.
It keeps to be... Exactly. But before we all get excited about all this, we're going to take a look at some ancient racism real quick. It's now believed by many scholars that the Spanish of the time simply added white or light skin to the stories of the Viracocha. Now, various reasons have been given, but not one singled out as the main reason why. But some believe it was to kind of help their stature later on with young natives growing up and would read it. Like, they tried to change their history. So when you read the history, you would believe something different. You follow me?
Yeah, history's written by the winners.
All the time. But interestingly enough, I found this little nugget that I'd like to share with all y'all with this. Some suggest that Quetzalcoatl was a northern medieval hero. Now, I've read on there where they talk about the plumed serpent wasn't a beard, it was feathers. You know, it was a feathered headdress, or it was feathers that they wore. Others say it was actually a beard. Now, there is a tale of a fellow named Bjorn, the champion of the Broadwickers. And there's a story written called the Irabjaga Saga. Now, I know I probably butchered that, so bear with me. But in his story of Bjorn, the champion, it's about how he lost his course leaving Iceland for Europe. And in the saga, there's a source, of course, and apparently this is a very valid source of sagas to tell of the Greenlanders' immigration to Vinland. And we know Vinland was a real place, so we know that happened. We do know for a fact that they found all that settlement. And according to this Irabjaga or whatnot saga, that Bjorn, the champion, during his Viking route back in Europe, leaves his native Iceland because of an illicit love, that he had an affair with a married woman named Thurid, and she was wife of Thorod the tax collector. And people were convinced that their son was actually the bastard offspring of Bjorn. Well, Thurid's brother comes up to old Bjorn. It just so happens that her brother is the magistrate. The magistrate named Snorri. And he admits that living in the same county, he cannot stay away from Snorri's sister. He's like, look, I can't do it. You know, I'm in love with her. I'm sorry. And I know if I stay, there's going to be a fight. It's going to be brutal. There's going to be a war. My men are going to go against his men. It's going to be bad. The only problem is that when Snorri caught Bjorn, he kind of caught him off guard, caught him by surprise. Bjorn didn't have his weapons with him. Didn't have a shield, an axe, sword, nothing. So he pretty much tells him, he says, Bjorn, you got to get out of here. I'm pretty much forcing you. Get gone. Go lie low for a few years. Go back to Europe. Let's let this blow over, right? That's what we're looking to do. So that's what happens. He agrees. Okay, I'm going to get out of here. So they leave. Snorri leaves, and he goes back to this place, Hallafell. And Bjorn, he goes south, and he gets on a ship. And he takes his ship, and he goes for the summer, and he leaves, him and his men. They say somewhat late and ready where they were, but they left with this northeasterly area, and they leave. And prevail, this is long that summer. And this is where they catch up. And apparently, this Snorri fella caught up with Bjorn decades later. They bumped into each other again after Bjorn had left, and he asked him what had happened, what was going on. Now, this comes from the saga written. It says, late in the days of King Olaf the Holy, Guldef went a merchant voyage west to Dublin. And when he sailed from the west, he was minded for Iceland. And he sailed round Ireland by the west and fell in with gales from east and northeast. And so drove a long way west into the main and southwestern Wythel, so that they saw naught of land. But then was the summer pretty far spent, and therefore they made many vows that they might escape from out the main. But so it befell at last that they were aware of land. A great land it was, but they knew not what land. Then such red took Guldolf and his crew that they should sail unto the land, for they thought it ill to have to do any more with the main sea. And so then they got them good haven. And when they had been there a little while, men came to meet them, whereof none knew, though they deemed somewhat that they spoke in the Erse tongue. At last they came in such throngs that they made many hundreds, and they laid hands on them all and bound them, and drove them up into the country. And they were brought to a certain moat, and were doomed thereat. And this they came to know, that some would that they should be slain, and others some that they should be allotted to the country folk and be their slaves. And so, while these matters are in debate, they see a company of men come riding, and a banner borne over the company. And it seemed to them that there should be some great man amongst these. And so as that company drew nigh, they saw under the banner a man riding, big, and like a great chief of aspect, but much stricken in years. And all they who were there before worshipped that man, and greeted him as their lord. And they soon found all that counsels and awards were brought whereas he was. So this man sent for Guldolf and his folk. And whereas they came before him, he spoke to them in the tongue of the Northmen, and asked them whence of lands they were. They said that they were Icelanders for the more part. So the man asked who the Icelanders might be. Then Guldolf stood before the man and greeted him in worthy wise. And he took this greeting well, and asked whence of Iceland he was. And he told him of Burgfirth. Then asked he whence of Burgfirth he was, and Guldolf told him. After that he asked him closely concerning each and all of the mightiest men of Burgfirth and Brogfirth. And amidst this speech he asked concerning Snorri the priest, and his sister Thurid of Fraudswater, and most of all of the youngling, Kara Tan, who in those days was gotten to be a good man. But now, meanwhile, the folk of that land were crying out in another place that some counsel should be taken concerning the ship's crew. So the big man went away from them and called to him by name 12 his own men, and they sat talking a long while and thereafter went to the man-mote. And the big man said to Gundulf and his folk, "We people of the country have talked your matter over somewhat, and they have given the whole thing up to my ruling, and I, for part, will give you leave to go your way. And although ye may be deemed that summer wears late now, yet will I counsel you to get gone hence, for here dwelleth a folk untrusty and ill to deal with, and they deem their laws to be already broken by you." Gundulf says, "We shall. We say concerning this, it's best for us to leave this land of our kin as to those who have given us our freedom." So, there's a lot more goes back and forth between these two. A lot of it goes back and forth. What you come up with is this. That...
yeah, I'm a little lost.
Bjorn never came back. Bjorn left. Gundulf was the man that came back and spoke to Snorri about Bjorn. So, decades later, after he left, Snorri tells him, "You're cheating with my brother's wife. I'm sorry, you're cheating with my sister on my brother-in-law." That's what Snorri was doing. Telling Bjorn. Bjorn was sleeping with this woman, which was Snorri's sister. So Snorri goes, "Look, dude, I'm the magistrate. You got to get out of here before all hell breaks loose." So basically, he banishes him for 2 or 3 years.
Right.
Decades later, he's still never seen him. This Gundulf guy comes back and tells of these travels. And while he's traveling, Gundulf and those guys get lost, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And end up in South America. That's what they're saying, down in Mexico. They end up down in South America. While they're down in South America, they ran into a guy that knows Snorri and the woman and her husband and her kid by name. And it pretty much comes out in the talking that this guy is Bjorn. So what they're saying is, could this have been where some of these stories have started about bearded men teaching them different ways? Is a giant white bearded man was a Viking living amongst them, that he sailed with his crew down there, and that's where he was staying. Because they're going back through a lot of these tales and these sagas. That's what the people are looking at. Now there's, look, you could reach out and people, like I said, you can look into a whole bunch of this. We don't know. We don't know for sure if this is the Bjorn, if it's a different guy. We're not sure. All we do know is that when they finally parted and the whole thing fell apart, Gundulf and all of his men laid and they took off, that he gets back to Iceland. He delivers all these gifts. And that what he can say is that he believes it's true, that it must have been Bjorn that was there. That what he told him and everything that he was, he's like, this had to be the guy.
Right.
This guy down there. So it still goes back into this. We know more than likely that the stories from Peru and the Andes and all that stuff with the Viracocha, that happened way before this. All right. That's way before the Vikings sailed down there. But were they treating him this way, treating him nicely, like a man, like a god, because of his looks? Because if that's a fact, and he was down there, of course, way before the Spaniards got down there to document these words,
right?
Then it's pretty simple to see that the Spaniards didn't change the wording to make it bearded white men, that they already believed it was bearded white men.
Yeah.
So it comes full circle back around, is something about these bearded white men, it ties. I don't know how it ties in. I don't have any idea. I'm not even sure I believe that they're white. It's just something about these bearded men, but they do have European features when they talk about any of it in their history,
right?
And when you see these carvings. So the Viracocha goes way deeper than what I thought. They view them as their creator, as their God, almost like their God and their Jesus. And then they also view them as the teachers. And it's not just one. There's multiple stories from different stretches of these people that look that way.
Yeah, that's my favorite part, is different people from different parts of the world all are seeing the same thing.
Yes, the whole thing.
Bearded men that come out of the sea, that teach them about agriculture, that teach them about civilization, you know, mathematics, all this stuff.
So
building.
Let's just leave it at that. We do know that, of course, we go to Viking because it's a broad brush. We don't know. We're not sure about which, you know, nationality they really are. But it's just a broad brush when you say Viking. We already know that they were master ship builders, correct? They were great.
Yeah, we know that. Yeah.
White men with beards. That fits, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that they were sailing way sooner than what we give them credit for, what modern history gives them credit for now. What if they were sailing over there and trading and teaching? Now, I don't understand the robes. I don't have any idea. But maybe some of their Odinist, you know, priests or whatever it was, that their shaman, whatever they were, maybe that's how they dressed. I don't know. Maybe that's how they dressed after they got there. I don't know. But it does seem to fit when they come out of the sea. It ties in. Now, I can't tie in the fact that they look like fish. I have no idea what that would be, unless they were all fishermen. And that was another idea, is they showed up and they're fishermen. Or, let's go so far and crazy, I know that they wore leather armor. I don't know about chain mail, but could the chain mail, could the metal armor overlapped, look like scales on their legs?
Right, I know what you're saying. Yeah, that's a good point.
I don't know.
To an indigenous person, yes, they would think it was scales. Yeah.
It does tie in a lot like that. And like I said, I don't think there's any nailing it down. I don't think we're ever going to know, really. Unless, because I think there's too many books burnt, there's too much history lost for us to know the real truth. But that's what I said at the beginning, is we're going to throw out lines and see which tangles together. So I don't know if this has confused more people than it helped, but at least there is a lot. I found a lot out about this that I didn't know there were more ties to it, as far as the way the Viracocha legends came in. I just felt like it was just all Atlantean. I don't know if it's all Atlantean now.
I gotcha. Well, that's very interesting, man. Well, let's take a break. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. I love the stories of Viracocha, of Quetzalcoatl, of Inki, and all these other gods, you know, that come from the water. They're described as having a fish tail, and they're spreading the knowledge among these people. Now, you know, there's, like you talked about, there's theories that these people were survivors of Atlantis, that when the Atlantis was submerged by the ocean, they filtered out to different parts of the world, and when they showed up to all these other indigenous cultures, they were able to spread the knowledge because the Atlanteans were supposed to be the most superior human beings at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it may be simply that. We've talked about it lots of times. Today, we're talking with these computers, these cell phones we got here on these desks, these tablets, these laptops, everything. But at the same time, there's a guy living in the jungle who is living just like it was 8,000 years ago. Could there have been a real Atlantis and then other cultures all over the world that were far inferior when it comes to science and agriculture, civilization, laws? And when these people filtered out, they were these bringers of knowledge. I mean, that seems plausible to me. I mean, I think they just discovered a new tribe that was completely, had no contact with man until now, of course. And now they're probably going to screw that up.
You're right.
But it does seem like that, right? I mean, that's, I love the story. Now, as far as, you know, the details of the fish-like body and stuff, that just might be like you're talked about. Confusing armor, you know, not chainmail, but like, yeah, armor scales or something like that, or just the way they looked. They might have thought it looked like a fish like body or something. I don't know. Very, very interesting.
Well, it's one of those things that you can only describe if you have words for it.
Yeah.
If you don't have words for it, you can't describe it. So you have to use your words, because that's how you would, you know, you only use the vernacular, only use the language that you understand, that you grasp. And that may have been their only language, is it looks like a fish. You know, that's like we talked about before, that they thought that whenever they first saw the Spaniards get off on their horses, that it was half horse, half man.
That's
because
right,
they hadn't seen horses. So they see these guys riding around them. They didn't know that they were two separate things at first.
And yeah,
it doesn't mean you're stupid. It doesn't mean that the natives, those people are just obviously stupid. I'm like, no, you're not. You just, something you had never seen before. We go through it all the time. How many times do you try to do something new? Anybody our age now, the minute you try to do something new, you walk into a place, you look like an idiot because you don't know what you're looking at. You don't know what you're, like when you first go to buy something, you don't ever have any at it. You don't know. And I think that's it. I think that we got, somewhere I think it's lost in translation.
I think you're right. I mean, you were blowing my mind with the story of Gandalf and George Snorri and whatever
right?
else. I mean, I was like, man, my mind is flipping out. I don't know what Cam's even talking about.
It's confusing when you dig into it that deep. Like I kind of like just the plain, no BS, cut to the chase. Viracocha come from the waters. He taught him how to grow some crops and he left. He wore a robe, got a big beard, and that was it.
Yeah.
But like most things, you go digging into it, it gets a lot more convoluted than that.
Yeah. Well, let's talk quickly about our sponsors before we get out of here. If you're lucky enough to be an Expanded Perspectives Elite member, last Elite show, Cam was talking about these Native American giants. And our sponsor, Gaia, this is a video streaming service, they have a new documentary out about giants. So check this out.
Legends throughout the world have spoken of a race of giants that once walked the earth. But are they legends? If they are merely legends, then how can we have skeletal remains of human giants, 8 to 12 feet tall, that have been discovered all over the world, throughout history, and even further back? In America alone, there have been over 1,500 newspaper accounts as far back as the 1800s. On the island of Catalina, California, in 1920, 3,781 skeletons of a race of blonde-haired giants were found and exhumed. In fact, there are real accounts of exhumed giants with double rows of teeth, and in some cases, six fingers. If this is so, where is the evidence? Many have accused the Smithsonian Institution of covering up these discoveries, locking the giant skeletons away and depriving the public of their findings. But the Smithsonian insists that no physical specimens of such creatures remain, and that they never existed. This stunning revelation, the Smithsonian conspiracy, and factual case studies are revealed and examined in A Race of Giants.
There you go. If you'd like to see that documentary, man, you got to get over to Gaia.com, sign up for it. Gaia is a video streaming service, just like Netflix or Hulu, and they have over 7,000 titles over there. They have videos on yoga, on transformation, on seeking truth. They have films, they have documentaries, they have more. And this is just one of the many videos that you can watch over there. I love it. If you sign up now, I think it's like $9.95 a month. And there's access to over 7,000 titles. You can watch this on Apple TV. You can watch this on your Roku. You can get an app and put it on your phone and watch it. It's very cool. I mean, if you like documentaries like we do, especially about ancient cultures, and Michael Tellinger's got a series over there. If you like conspiracy theories about how Nazis were working with extraterrestrials to create UFOs and doing these, you know, the Die Glock, the Nazi bell, and they were able to travel to another dimension and there was time slips and stuff, then you can go and watch the Deep Space series. There's just tons of them. If you like wisdom teachings, there's a guy over there named David Wilcock. You've seen him on Ancient Aliens. He does this series of interviews with a guy that says he worked and is no longer works there with the military, and he was working on the moon or something. I don't know. There's just so many of them over there, but you got to check it out, folks. Go over to Gaia.com, Gaia.com. Also, I'd like to talk today a moment about our sponsor, Blue Apron. Now, you've probably heard me mention it in the beginning of today's show, and most of you probably already know what Blue Apron is because you've heard of it on another podcast or another radio station. I've even seen commercials on television recently. Blue Apron is a fresh ingredient delivery service, and what that means is they ship delicious meals right to your doorstep. All you have to do is cook it. Now, everyone's lives are super busy, and even more so if you got kids. I talk about it all the time on the show. Everybody who listens knows that I've got my full-time job. My wife has her full-time job. The kids play baseball and other things after school. And so during the middle of the week, it gets pretty hectic. And sometimes by the time you're running around, doing your honeydews, picking up a gallon or two of milk at the grocery store, running the kids, by the time you get home, it's very hard to sit down and have a family meal. That's why I think most families probably get together and do it on Sundays.
Yeah.
It's hard to get together and do a family meal. And it's not because you don't want to. It's because you're just limited on time. Well, Blue Apron's made it very easy. If you don't want to stop by and grab some fast food, which I suggest you don't do, everyone knows that. You know, you want to cook a healthy meal, but you don't have time to set it all out and thaw this out and try to get the ingredients right. Blue Apron does it all for you. They send you these meals. They're different meals every week, and they never repeat the same meals for the entire year. So you may get that same meal again, but it won't be for at least 12 months. Save up these cards. If you cook something from Blue Apron and you really like it, you could save that recipe card and you could make it again on your own. You could give it to other people. Very cool. They say they have two services now. They got two plans. One is for a two-person plan. One is for a family plan. And, you know, there's gorgeous things over there. Like this week's on the menu for the two-person plan, they got these cheesy chicken and black bean enchiladas. That looks delicious. This creamy shrimp spaghetti. And over on the family plan, they have blackened Cajun catfish, Cam, and Thai chicken noodle soup.
I'm going to be tearing up that soup.
Now, like I said, we got the packages, and we tried it out on my own. Me and my wife did. The Bruds, they didn't want to eat that. They don't like super fancy food. They like meat and cheese and two circle breads.
That's right.
Yeah. Which is what they call a hamburger, or at least they used to. But me and my wife did it, and she's an excellent cook. And we got in the kitchen together, and we prepared it, and it was easy, and it was fast. They say that every meal takes no longer than 40 minutes to prepare, so that's really not a lot of time. You can sit there and let your kids do their homework while you're preparing the meal for the family, and it's very, very good. The two-person plan, you can get three meals per week for under $10, and the family plan, you can choose 2 to 4 meals a week for under $70. Shipping is always free. You can skip any week you want to, and you can cancel anytime. All new chefs get $30 off your first delivery. You go to blueapron.com/expanded. Cam.
Yes, sir.
What do you got planned for your weekend?
Man, my whole week.
You got
busy.
A week before you get to the weekend.
Yep, I got busy. Weather's going to be great. I'm going to be busy. We got a bunch of stuff going on, monkeying around with stuff at work and everything. But just normal stuff, normal grind, nothing really out of control, nothing real crazy. The doctor didn't release my mother, so I've got at least 2 more weeks of her staying with me again. So, yeah, I'm still dealing with all that stuff. Other than that, nothing. I would like to give a quick shout-out and congratulations to our training partners and our good friends, Dakota Ranello with his win this weekend by rear naked choke. Miss Anna Snyder won by decision, and our professor, Mr. Dondi Morgan, lost by decision there at the very end of it. Had a judoka, a man that had been was a judo black belt and been practicing judo for over 40 years, and a Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt. They couldn't do anything with each other. They went back and forth, back and forth. It was a 10-minute war,
man,
and neither one of them could get anywhere. And I'd like to be a big shout out, a big thank you, and a congratulations, and all this. Every bit of good energy and good love that you could pass out to two good friends of ours, and I know they're probably listening, Mr. Logan Huffman and Miss Lisa Veronica. They're engaged, they're going to be married, and we are going to do our darndest to get over there and be part of that whole thing. Yeah, we are looking at it. I think they're going to get hitched. Whenever they do, we're going to be there. We're going to that whole deal. So it'll be a big party.
It'll be fun. That's right.
All be
right.
Fun times.
For you elite members, we'll be speaking to you on Thursday. For everybody else, don't forget, if you want to send your story to the show, you can email us at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can call the show 817-945-3828, and you can always follow us on social media. For everybody, we'll talk to you next week. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.